It's business time, baby.
The Sala Monster sounds off.
My client,
Mama Monster,
conquered the streak.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
Fat delete.
You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Welcome to episode 549 of the Sala Monster Sounds Off here, the first sound off for June here in 2018. It is Sunday, June 3rd, to be exact. I am the Sala Monster. Thank you, everybody, who has been checking up on me and my my poor knee here. I keep thinking of that Family Guy meme where the father, whose name now escapes me, is sitting on the ground clutching his knee in pain. So the good news, for those who care, is that the stitches came out Thursday, and it's healing. It still hurts, but it's healing. The bad news is that two x-rays show two different things. One shows nothing in the knee, and the other shows what may be glass in my knee, which means when they stitched Humpty Dumpty Sala Monster back together in Colombia, they may not have cleaned all the glass out of the wound beforehand. So I went to an orthopedist who showed me the two x-rays, and he pointed out, he shows, you know, one of them shows a piece of something. It could be glass, it could be a bone fragment that came loose when I bashed my knee. They're not really sure. And if it is a bone fragment that, you know, came loose, apparently it'll just fuse together with my knee. This is the way it was explained to me, and that there's really nothing to do for it. It'll just sort of naturally, I guess it'll sort of by osmosis or whatever, become part of the knee. If it is glass, I have to have surgery. So that's the really crappy part. And what they'll have to do is open the knee back up and just sort of, I guess once it's all healed, they'll open it back up and then they'll clean out whatever is in there. So I have to wait a month and then I have to go back and they're going to do another x-ray. All these x-rays, I'm going to be glowing when this whole thing is over with. And if it looks exactly the same in a month, then it's probably glass and they'll send me for, I guess, a CT scan to pinpoint exactly where in the knee it is so they know where to go in. And then I would have to have surgery. So I have to wait 6 weeks just to find out if I'm going to need this operation or not. I'm not too thrilled about that. I also have almost no feeling in the front part of my knee or on the left side of my knee, which is probably from the friggin' bandage that was wrapped around my leg so tight for all those days. Who the hell knows if that'll, you know, the feeling will ever come back there. In the front part, I was told it won't, which I guess is great because if I bash my knee again, that means I won't feel a thing. But yeah, that's the update. I just am really depressed and just pissed at myself, really, for the entire thing. It's nobody else's fault. It's my own damn fault. So I'm just depressed and pissed about that. But hey, it could have been a lot worse. I keep thinking, man, if I tripped and fell forward, I would have put my face through that glass. And that would have been a hell of a lot worse. I'd look like the Elephant Man right now. I'd be like Stone Cold on that one episode of SmackDown. During the two-man power trip. Remember when Undertaker threw Austin through the window backstage? He was like on a rampage. He found Austin. He threw him through this window backstage. And they strap, Austin's all bleeding. They strap him to a stretcher. And he just keeps shouting at Vince and Triple H. He keeps going, "I've got glass in my eye. I've got glass in my eye. I didn't do nothing to that man. I don't deserve this." As they wheeled him to the ambulance, "I don't deserve this." He just kept repeating over and over again. You know, I know it wasn't best for business turning Austin back in 01, but it sure did give us a lot of great comedic moments that year. So for me, it was totally worth it when you go back and you watch those old Stone Cold moments like that, or the stuff with Kurt Angle, you know, playing the banjo, the cowboy hat, the badge, all that kind of stuff. So anyway, but thank you to everybody who's been asking. Hopefully I don't need that surgery. If I do, though, it's going to suck. Audible. Thank you for everybody who's been signing up via Audible using our link, audibletrial.com/Sala Monster. You can sample the service for 30 days. And if you are looking to get yourself a free book, you can use our link to do that too, because it's part of the trial. You get one free audiobook of your choice. And even if you cancel the trial so you don't get billed, that book belongs to you. audibletrial.com/Sala Monster. So hop on there. There's a ton of wrestling books. I noticed that Bob Holly was the subject of one of the newest Something to Wrestle episodes that Conrad did with Bruce Pritchard this week. I haven't had the chance yet to listen to it. I want to. I think it's like a 3.5 hour show. Just talking about the career of Bob Holly in WWE. And, you know, when I had Bob on the show many years ago, and it's still probably my best interview, my favorite interview that I've done with a wrestler. It was just, you know, we just had a good rapport and we've kept in touch ever since. And Bob with me has always been a class guy. Even recently, and when my mother passed away, he must have saw something I posted on Twitter. And I think I told the story. You know, I get this text message from a number I wasn't familiar with, and I couldn't figure out who it was. And then thankfully he told me, because the number I had in my phone, I don't know if it's an old number or just a different number, but he took the time to text me, and some really nice stuff too. We went back and forth, and I made it a point this year in New Orleans to, at WrestleCon, hunt him down so we can meet face to face. And we chatted for a few minutes, and, you know, maybe we'll get him back on the show at some point. He's definitely open to it. But when I had him on the show the first time, you know, part of it was to promote his book, The Hardcore Truth, which is one of the best wrestling books that I've read. It just comes across, yes, it's his account, it's his version of events, but it just comes across as a very raw, honest accounting of his life, but also his career in WWE. And he spent a lot of years in WWE. He had longer than most. You know, you think of some of the longer tenured stars on the roster in this company, and, you know, you think of people like Undertaker, and you think of Shawn Michaels, but then you have guys kind of, you know, beneath them, like Billy Gunn, who spent a long time in the company, and he was in and out, but Bob Holly had a hell of a run, a 15-year run in that company. And there was some controversy involved there, but as far as books go, just to kind of bring it back to the whole Audible thing, you can't go wrong if that's one book, if you're not sure what you might want to sort of cash in on with the link. I can't recommend that book enough, because it's just a really fun read. I also have a whole review of the book if you're ever interested. It's up on the YouTube channel. So anyway, that was sort of my little news tie-in there if you want to check out that version of Bruce and Conrad's show. They covered Bob Holly this week, but you can also go back in the archives and check out my interview with him. Also want to say thank you to everybody who donated via PayPal this week. I would be remiss if I did not take a couple of minutes here at the top of the show to thank all of you. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname and a shout-out, as you know, here on the show. I want to say thank you to John Loose Cannon Lopez, Deadpool James Herrera, Out of Control Cody Thomas. I'm almost thinking I should just, like, record this instead of actually saying it every week, and I could just push the play button on those three names. But thank you to them, the Florida Freebird, Brian Becerra, Beast Mode, Brock Joseph, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, Ryan the Dagger McTaggart, the Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard, the Malaysian Mastermind, Samuel T, Radiant Ray Wrighton. Hey Dave from Brooklyn, don't ever forget who put you onto the Solomonster, I'm just saying. Raymond the Mounty Medina, the Show Off, Corey Van Dam, Save the World, Sean Tilly, the Bogota Big Shot, Fernando Leon, the Renton Road Warrior, Taylor Schatt, the Ambassador of Disaster, Chase Wood. Thank you for the donation and for buying a shirt Chase did this week. That is mighty nice of you. The Anarchist, Andrew Heller, Black Death, Justin Hesse, the Reno Renegade, Wayne Ashanti, Master Contender R. Kyle Marr, and I also want to take a moment here to wish a very happy birthday to Webmaster Mike of SEScoops.com, our former home. He is celebrating his 69th birthday today. He looks good for 69. Also want to wish a happy birthday to Kevin Castle of the Don Tony and Kevin Castle Show. So hopefully he's having a good birthday weekend as well. The defamation lawsuit brought against CM Punk and Colt Cabana by Dr. Chris Amon of WWE finally made it to court this past week, a little over a week before Punk has his next fight at UFC 225 next Saturday against Mike Jackson. Not the ideal time to be fighting a slander suit, but the wheels of justice move slowly, and it just so happened that this was the week for the trial to begin, since neither side apparently seemed very interested in settling out of court. So the nuts and bolts are this. Punk walked out on WWE, as many of you know, in January 2014. This was right after the Royal Rumble, the night after, in fact. He claimed he was sick. He had a staph infection that went undiagnosed by WWE medical staff, namely Dr. Amon. He did a tell-all podcast later that year with his then-best friend, Colt Cabana. Supposedly, I think there was some, or there may have been some sort of falling out between the two of them later on. I'm not sure if they've since patched things up or not. I mean, they were seen talking and interacting and during breaks in the trial this week, so it's not like they're not on speaking terms. But on that podcast, Punk obviously had some very derogatory things to say about the Good Doctor, which Eamon took exception to. He claimed that Punk's version of events was incorrect, and that as a result of that podcast, it had caused him great harm and great emotional distress from wrestling fans who would catcall him at WWE shows and who would tweet him nasty things on social media. Oh, if only I could sue for nasty things that people said about me on social media, I'd be quite the rich man. I think Punk is of the belief that WWE, and he said this before, he's of the belief that WWE is secretly bankrolling Eamon's lawsuit, although that's never been proven to be true. This is, WWE is supposedly has nothing to do with any of this, and this suit was brought forth independently by Eamon, independent of his employment with WWE. WWE is supposedly just a sideline watcher. They're watching from the sidelines. They have no vested interest in this, even though they obviously do. Most people figured that one or both sides would want to settle this well before it ever came to this point. That did not happen, and so here we are. Now, I want to just say hat tip to Nick Hausman and Ross Berman of WrestleZone.com for these notes. A lot of what I'm going to get into here is borrowed from their version of events. They were in the courthouse each day of the trial, not together, but between the two of them, they were able to share a lot of information, far more than what I'm sharing here with you. So if you want all the little details, all the little boring details that go on in court, they have all that covered on the website. But these are the more interesting parts. I figured I'd go day by day after 4 days of this trial here and let you know exactly what happened this week in the great lawsuit between Dr. Eamon, CM Punk, and Colt Cabana. So day one of the trial kicked off on Tuesday. It was in Cook County, Illinois. Eamon is seeking $1 million in compensatory damages and an unspecified amount in punitive damages. He testified on his own behalf on day one. He even read some of the tweets that he had received from people calling for him to be fired, and they were mocking him, Dr. Z-Pak and all this other stuff. The jurors also were able to listen to the entire Art of Wrestling episode where Cabana interviewed Punk. What must some of those jurors be thinking? The non-wrestling fans among them, which may well be all of them for all we know. We don't know if any of them are wrestling fans or not. I just look at this and I go, what must they be thinking with some of these stories that were probably told on that podcast, right? And Vince told me, make Roman look strong. It's like, I would have loved to have seen some of the expressions on their faces. Like, why is this not airing on the network? You could have pre- and post-show analysis with Clarence Mason and just like a court TV type deal. Just air this on the network, live coverage each day. I'd be glued to my monitor. Day two of the trial had Eamon back on the stand in the morning. He actually showed one very abusive tweet from a CM Punk fan that called him a, quote, Z-Pak retard, end quote. One tweet came from a Twitter account with the name Mike Litteris, which got a laugh from the people in the courtroom. Got a laugh out of me, too, because I guess I'm 5 years old. But yes, poor Mike Litteris was very abusive on Twitter towards Dr. Eamon. This is just fantastic. I love this. So Eamon explained to the jury how a Royal Rumble match works. He talked about what happened in the Rumble match in 2014, his interaction with Punk during the match, during which Punk suffered a concussion. The order was given once they realized Punk had some sort of head injury or that he might be concussed. The order was given for him to eliminate himself. Punk was having none of that. He did not want to interfere with whatever, the creative plans were. He was supposed to be in the final four, which I think he may have been anyway. I mean, he was in there for a long time, probably 40, 45 minutes. It's not like he was dumped, prematurely the way that Daniel Bryan was in 2015, where he was in there for probably not even 10 minutes. But he did not, heed their requests. He was not interested in leaving the match early. So they ended up sending Kane down to the ring to get rid of him. And this was during that whole corporate Kane phase, if you'll recall, where he pretty much ruined everything every week on those shows by interfering in various matches. I mean, if you were in bed with your new wife about to consummate the marriage right before climax, Kane would interfere and ruin the moment. That was just sort of his thing back then. So then there was a text message exchange that was shared in court between Punk and the doctor, where Punk says that he is sick, and he asks the doctor if he has a Z-Pack. And of course, naturally, Dr. Amon responds, "Yes, I've got them on me." I picture him wearing one of those ammo belts, like in Rambo, only it's Z-Packs instead of bullets. There was also another text exchange. This one was pretty damning, I think, between Amon and Chris Jericho, where they were talking, and he told Jericho that Punk's health was nothing like the way he described, which led Punk's lawyer in court to ask, why did Amon feel that it was okay to disregard HIPAA privacy laws in those text messages? So, which is actually a very good question. I'm not sure we got an answer to. Day three of the trial opened with the video testimony of Mark Carano of WWE. He talked about the night of the Rumble, Punk getting hurt by Kofi Kingston. I guess when Kofi rolled into the ring, he immediately clotheslined Punk. If you watch that match back, Punk, I think, claimed that was where he suffered a concussion. He talked about the referees interacting with Punk and Punk being very aggravated, very agitated. He was irate after being eliminated by Kane from the match. There was no sign of any lump, he said, on Punk's back, nor did Punk ever bring up his back with him in their conversations. Now remember, Punk claimed that he had this really like nasty purplish lump on his lower back. I think even at one point in court when he was testifying, he sort of acknowledged his own mistake and that he sometimes describes it as being on his back when really it was on his butt. But, you know, it was sort of right around where his waistband would be, right, of his tights. So it's possible that nobody would have seen it unless this guy pulled down his trunks. So just because Carano didn't see it doesn't mean that it wasn't there. It also doesn't mean that it was there, right? We don't know for sure. I'll say this, though. This would make for a very boring episode of Law and Order for all this arguing back and forth about whether or not there was a lump on this guy's back. The jury also saw video testimony from future Knox County, Tennessee Mayor Kane. He was asked at one point, "You eliminated CM Punk from the 2014 Royal Rumble, correct?" To which he replied, "Illegally, yes." And Punk giggled in court at that answer. Again, I reiterate, why is this not on the network? So Colt Cabana later on, he took the stand to testify. He was asked far too many boring questions about the analytics of his podcast and how many people listened to it. And there was a dispute about the number of people who listened to it that he claimed. I almost fell asleep reading this. But then there was a funny moment where Dr. Amon's attorney suddenly stopped his line of questioning and realized that he had been reading from the wrong deposition. And so he began all over again. And Cabana, at that point, I guess, must have also questioned him about something, because then Cabana got yelled at by the judge for doing so. I'm reading this, and I just think of that dog in the burning house meme, like, you know, this is going well. Everything is fine. Day four had Cabana back on the stand in the middle of his testimony. An entire class of eighth graders apparently entered the classroom, the courtroom, courtroom. I don't know if they stormed the courtroom with Nerf guns or what. All the notes said here is that they entered the room, so I assume unarmed. Cabana claims that he saw Punk shirtless at his house, wearing the, quote, camo shorts that he always wears, because who among us does not have a casual pair of camo shorts that we wear around the house? I'm staring at mine right now, actually. All of a sudden, the defense suddenly produces said pair of camo shorts from underneath the desk, and they enter it as exhibit, I wrote exhibit 117. I don't know what the first 116 exhibits were, but this was exhibit 117, which Colt Cabana on the stand under oath identifies, in fact, as the camo shorts that were worn by CM Punk. Then comes my favorite exchange of the trial so far. The lawyers get into an argument over how much footage can be shown in court from the 2014 Royal Rumble. Heyman's lawyers do not want footage of Kane chokeslamming Punk through the announce table to be shown to the jury. And to be fair, no one should be shown footage of the 2014 Royal Rumble. I wish I hadn't seen footage of the 2014 Royal Rumble, so I would not want to subject the jury to it either. So the judge then turns around and she says she doesn't know who Kane is. She's like, I don't know who Kane is. One of the lawyers tells her he's the big man without a shirt, which really narrows it down in a Royal Rumble match, no less. She then calls the lawyers into the hallway where shouting is heard. I just am reading this and I'm thinking, this is amazing. I take back what I said before. This would make for a great Law and Order episode. Punk finally takes the stand. He gets very emotional. He says, you know, hearing about who I was back then, you know, I guess he was in a bad place, and hearing how I behaved and who I was back then just brings up memories of things I don't care about anymore. I assume by that he means pro wrestling, which is sad. I mean, it's sad. Not that I'm excusing, I'm saying Punk isn't an innocent angel here and all that, but just, you can tell, here's a guy who was wrestling his entire life, he had a passion for it, and just to see how that passion was just beaten out of him is a really sad thing. He also confirmed, I guess this was a bit of news this week, he confirmed that the CM in CM Punk does in fact stand for Chick Magnet, which is not a big secret. He was part of a tag team early in his career on the indies called the Chick Magnets. It was CM Punk and CM Venom. But over the years, he's kind of joked around. He's had some fun with it when people ask him the question. And so he's claimed at different points that it stood for Chicago Made. Sometimes he says it stands for Cookie Monster. He did a Q&A a few years back for the UFC. This is before his first fight, but after he had signed with UFC. And he did this online Q&A. Where he claimed that the CM stood for Chuck Mosley, who was part of the group Faith No More. He claimed that his friends used to call him Chuck Mosley, and he just took it and shortened it to CM. And this was reported at the time as news. This was taken seriously and reported as news at that time. So now, under oath, we finally get the truth that CM stands for Chick Magnet. Punk started crying at one point, and the judge called for a 15-minute recess to allow him to compose himself. This whole thing just reads like, if you really read the back and forth with the lawyers on both sides, like one day it seems like Heyman has the stronger case, the next day it sounds like Punk and Cabana have this in the bag. The whole thing reads like a gigantic waste of time. A lot of the text messages do seem to support Punk's version of events with regard to the lump. But it's also obvious, not that Punk is lying, but it's obvious that his recollection of certain events was not entirely accurate. He even admits that. He says, look, I could be off, like, some things maybe were exaggerated, but the crux of what I'm telling you here is true. But some details may not be. Now, Heyman is suing for over $1 million for emotional distress. But it has not, he admitted, it has not affected his standing in WWE at all. He never lost his job. He was never sent home. It's not like he's subjected to some kind of, internal abuse within the company every day he goes to work or anything like that. It hasn't affected his pay at all, his income. So it's hard to see him swaying enough jurors to punish Punk and Cabana. And Cabana really got screwed here because he didn't do anything wrong. You know, you could say, well, he gave Punk the platform to spew all these lies, which may not be lies. But you know, he gave him the platform to sort of defame this man. But, you know, I could tell you as a podcaster that if I were in that situation, I mean, it would be a horrible thing to go through because I have a lot of sympathy for Cabana. He sort of got roped into this whole thing, I think, out of spite, more than anything else. I think of all the people involved here, he's the one who's really getting screwed because he doesn't have the kind of money that CM Punk has, and he certainly doesn't have, I'm sure the money that either Heyman has or if WWE is maybe secretly supporting him, you know. Cabana doesn't have anything like that. You know, I'm sure he does well for himself, but he's not, Richie Rich over there, and so he's had to pay for all these legal expenses and everything. He can't recoup that. I mean, unless the jury comes back. I don't know if that's even possible, if the jury could sort of, you know, rule against Heyman and say, not only are we ruling against you, but you have to pay this man's legal fees. I don't even know if that's a possibility here, but that's probably not going to happen. So he's the one who I really feel the most for. The judge told the jurors that closing arguments in the case should take place on Tuesday, so that's when things should wrap up. At that point, we'll see how long it takes the jury to reach a verdict. My guess is Eamon loses and everybody goes home, but Punk and Cabana are the ones who are out tens of thousands of dollars, and frankly, maybe more, in legal fees, which in the end is probably what WWE wanted. Enzo Amore is back, not in WWE, but with his first rap song. Now, this is after he announced a couple of weeks back. I didn't have a chance to talk about this because that was the one week that I took off. But he announced that the investigation into the allegations of rape, basically sexual assault against him, was closed and that no charges were being filed. So then he comes out with this song. The song is called Phoenix. Not only a song, but he's got a whole music video. This has obviously been in the works for quite a while. The song is called Phoenix, like a phoenix rising from the ashes or some such thing. I listened to it. I watched the video. Obviously, I wasn't a fan of the beginning of it, where he's basically just mocking wrestling fans. He's got this fat, out-of-shape guy eating Cheetos. And, you know, it's the stereotypical representation of internet wrestling fans. And he just, you know, completely... tears into wrestling fans at the beginning of the video, which I thought was kind of ridiculous. But I watched the video, I listened to the song. Honestly, it's no worse than any rappers that I've heard on SoundCloud, which is not to say it's good. It's not. But he's certainly no worse than some of the other people I've heard. And if you read the lyrics, I'm not going to read them all, but the lyrics are not all that bad, right? There's this one part of the song where he's like, you know, TMZ owes me some restitution in the midst of dissolution, choosing public prosecution over constitution ain't the right solution, gender persecution. All that is fine, whatever, except for the one part where he talks about his consensual penis. That may be one of the dumbest lyrics in the history of music. This is the part of the song, he goes, "They cry tears of joy at my funeral. Still, I rise from the ashes like a phoenix, middle finger to the sky, gripping my consensual penis. Lion-ass hoe out in Phoenix. When I say that shit, I mean it. Fuck you, Marks, for hatin'. This for all my fans waitin'. Entertainment's hottest free agent. Bitch, I'm reincarnated." So, the rest of the lyrics, though, aside from that, if you read them, are not terrible. Listening to him sing it is a different story, though. It's his first song. Maybe he'll get better at this. I don't know. I'm not really a fan of what I heard. But the reason I bring this up is, it also does not mean that he's coming back to WWE just because this case was dropped. This idea that I see some people peddling or even posts in the Facebook group and stuff, so now this paves the way, doesn't it, for Enzo to come back to WWE? Or WWE now has to bring him back. They did him wrong. They did him dirty. You know, when's he coming back? They don't have to bring him back. No, they don't. They don't have to ever bring him back. There's one of two things going on here. You either believe that A, they fired him because he failed to inform them that he was under investigation for rape by the police, which Enzo vehemently denies. He came out this week. He says he didn't even know about these charges until they were officially, this whole thing was made public. He denies ever knowing that he was under investigation until much later on, which, if he's telling the truth, can only lead to option B, which is that WWE was just fishing for a reason to get rid of the guy. There were already plenty of stories that I'm sure many of you remember reading about him rubbing people the wrong way backstage, him bringing people, guests who didn't belong there, into the locker room who were very disruptive. He made, you know, certain enemies behind the scenes with certain people. And then this happens. This, of all things to be accused of, he's accused of sexual assault. And that was all the reason they needed to cut ties with him, because who would question WWE over such a thing? And people did question them because they felt, well, it's not fair to Enzo, innocent until proven guilty. So there were people who came down hard on WWE when they first, you know, got rid of him. But, you know, it's hard to come down on the company too much because this person is accused of something heinous. Who wants to be associated with that, right? So they found their reason, and they took action. They kind of jumped at the chance to get rid of the guy. This gave them sort of the cover reason to do so. And if he's that big of a pain in the ass, why in the world, just because the investigation is now over, would they bring him back? Just because the charges were dropped? So what? They're under no obligation to bring this guy back. You know, I've seen other people say 205 Live has not been the same without him. That show needs him. 205 Live needs Enzo Amore. He was an attraction. The company could use him right now. I don't think WWE is any better or any worse without Enzo Amore. You either are a fan of what WWE is doing right now and you're excited by the product and you're excited by the shakeup and the way SmackDown looks now and Triple H is taking 205 Live in a different direction. NXT is kind of firing, I feel like, on all cylinders right now. You're either a fan of what WWE is doing or you hate what WWE is doing right now. You're bored by the product. You don't even watch week to week anymore. You want them, you just are waiting for this big creative wave to wash over this company. But I don't think in either one of those instances, no matter which side of the fence you fall on, does Enzo Amore even factor into this. Enzo coming back, I don't think changes anything for anybody. If they want to bring the guy back, great, go ahead and bring him back. I could personally give a rat's ass if he ever comes back, but some people might. I don't have any preference one way or the other. But just because the charges were dropped does not mean that WWE is under any obligation to bring this guy back. They don't have to do a damn thing. Raw was live from Richmond, Virginia last Monday night. No Roman Reigns this week. And honestly, I barely noticed. We had Seth Rollins defending his Intercontinental Championship against Jinder Mahal, who already won the WWE title and the United States Championship within the last year. So after Rollins interrupted Elias, who was performing or attempting to before the match, and basically he sent Elias to the back, I was terrified because I thought, wait a minute, they're going to have Elias come out, cost Rollins the match, just to put this title on Jinder as well. Thankfully, they had more common sense than that. Sunil Singh did try to interfere multiple times. Rollins got tired of it. He grabbed a chair from outside the ring and started hitting both of them with it, got himself DQ'd. And so he continued to terrorize Jinder and the Singh brother with chair shots in the aisleway until finally, you know, he had basically, banished, I think Jinder ran to the back. He got up on the announce table where the announcers are all set up, stood on the table, holding the chair high in the air. All of a sudden, and the way they shot this was great because you didn't see him coming, but Elias returned. He came back from the locker room and he demolished Rollins with a guitar shot to the back, shattered a guitar over his back. Rollins took a fall forward. Now, normally in these situations when they film this, I don't know why they do this. They shoot it in such a way, or if they shoot it well, they'll show you 5,000 replays that show, wait a minute, that wasn't that big of a fall, or, oh, that didn't look as impressive. And I'm always like, why would you replay this if you know it doesn't look as impressive on the replay? But the way this was shot, you just saw Rollins fall forward. He could have fallen 25 feet, you know? In reality, he probably fell 2 or 3, but it looked great. From the guitar shot to the fall, the whole thing looked great. They put a neck brace on Rollins. They loaded him up on a stretcher. He was like, just give me a minute. He refused to let them cart him out. He got up off the stretcher. This very serious, somber angle all of a sudden was interrupted by fans chanting happy birthday at Rollins. It was, in fact, his birthday. That aside, this was well done. I like the pairing of Rollins and Elias right now. I think it makes for a good feud right now. And they have the added luxury, if they want to do this, of bringing up the fact, and I don't think they did this on TV on Monday, but bring up the fact that it was Elias, if you remember, who stopped Rollins in that gauntlet match a few months ago on Raw. That was almost like this big breakout moment for Rollins, who, you know, Rollins was popular and he was doing well, but something changed after that Raw gauntlet match a few months ago, where he went like over an hour. He beat Roman Reigns and John Cena back-to-back in the same night, which for him, I mean, that's like the modern-day version, I guess, of Chris Jericho going around telling everybody, hey, I beat Stone Cold and The Rock in the same night. But it was just a masterful performance by Rollins in that match, and I think he really turned a corner. But his night came to an end at the hands of Elias. Elias hit Drift away and pinned him in the gauntlet match. So you know, it's just a minor thing. They don't have to mention it, but I think it's something worth bringing up. Maybe it's something that he can rub sort of in Seth's face, that he dashed Rollins' hopes of winning that entire gauntlet match. Now, I see this rumor online this week. This was like one of the big rumors of the week, that Seth Rollins may be challenging Brock Lesnar for the Universal Championship at SummerSlam, and he should. Hopefully this rumor becomes reality, and he does challenge for the Universal title at SummerSlam. And it should not be title for title. I'm not interested in Universal title versus IC title. They should get the IC title. If this happens, they should get the IC title off of him before then, if that is the plan, and they should put that Universal Championship on Seth Rollins at SummerSlam, because he is the man right now in this company. Lesnar has held that title hostage long enough. I have no desire to see a repeat of WrestleMania with them trying Roman Reigns in that spot yet again. Because I don't care, I guess. I don't buy into this whole storyline of, oh, it's the authority against Roman, right? Management is out to get me. Even though it kind of seems like they are, right? Because he got screwed at WrestleMania. I say screwed. I mean, if we're talking storyline, he got beat fair and square, but you know, everybody thought Roman was going to win. I thought Roman was going to win. And then Brock just basically beat him clean. And then you're like, oh, all right, well, maybe in Saudi Arabia they're going to put the championship on him and he'll get a nice reaction overseas. And they didn't do it there either. Maybe management really does not want the championship on Roman Reigns. But as far as the storyline, oh, you know, I'm not Vince McMahon's boy. Yes, you are. Yes, you are. You don't have to be in the quote-unquote internet fan to see that. You know, everybody knows that you're Vince McMahon's boy. And, you know, is it going to work out for him in the long run? Who knows? But it hasn't worked out the way they had hoped so far. But to buy into this notion that it's Roman versus, you know, the authority, basically, is, I think, a losing storyline. And if their goal here is to kind of build a SummerSlam with him getting one last chance where he slays the Beast, I think it's going to fall flat on its face. I think they had their shot with him. If they were going to pull the trigger on him, they should have done it at WrestleMania. They didn't do it. And so now we're heading into SummerSlam, and Seth Rollins is just on fire right now. And he's, you know, absolutely the one who I think of the two, I would go with certainly to be the person to beat Brock and take the championship. And I know I'm not the only one who feels that way. You know, I want somebody in there at SummerSlam, because here's my fear. I have no desire, like I was saying, to see a repeat of WrestleMania. With, let's say, they try Roman Reigns in that spot again, and you have the fans just shitting all over the end of the show. I want somebody in there like a Seth Rollins, or like a Braun Strowman, who the fans can genuinely get behind. I want them to be clamoring to see this guy, Brock Lesnar, lose this championship finally. I don't want to see them sitting there indifferent to whether or not the guy wins or loses. Or, you know, we'll just cheer for Brock. We actually are sick of him, but we'll cheer for him because we hate the other guy. You know, that happened at WrestleMania. Do we really need to see a repeat of this again at SummerSlam? Do we really need to see, you know, a repeat of this at their second biggest show of the year? You know, we already had it at the first. That's not what I'm interested in seeing. And with Rollins or Strowman, I'd be fine with either one. But frankly, I think it's better they go with Seth, because unlike Strowman, they can go with the story that Brock has never beaten Seth Rollins one-on-one. He's never done it. He almost did at that one pay-per-view a few years ago. And even, honestly, it's so long ago, it almost doesn't even matter now. But, you know, that was when the lights went out, they came back on, Undertaker kicked him in the dick. You know, we've been down this road before. But Rollins is one of the few guys Brock cannot say that he's beaten one-on-one. Can't say that about Strowman. Right? He beat Braun straight up, fair and square, right in the middle of the ring last year in that one match, that one awful match they had. Rollins is the guy for the spot, and Lesnar's run has gone on long enough. You build a run like that to peak with someone who the fans, you know, want to see conquer the champion and claim the title in the end. The time is now. And if Brock does decide to go back to UFC, they're going to have no choice but to take the title off of him anyway. Even if he stays, even if they throw some of those billions that they're getting from Fox, because Brock speaks the language of money more than anything else, if they throw enough money at him, they might be able to get him to stay and forego a UFC return. Maybe he'll stay for another 2-3 years. Even if that's the case, they got to get that belt off him ASAP. He is now to me, Lesnar, if I want to try to think of a modern day equivalence here, he has entered Andre territory. Andre the Giant was an attraction who did not need to be the WWF champion. That's why he only had the belt once. And that was literally for all of 60 seconds or 90 seconds before he surrendered it. I think there was value in putting the championship on Lesnar when they did, when he destroyed John Cena in that one SummerSlam match. That was fun. And they almost had to put the championship on him because they ended the streak, which I still think was a mistake, but they did it. And so how do you go from there? What can you possibly do after breaking The Undertaker's 21-year streak? Well, you put the championship on the guy and you send him on a monster run, which is exactly what they did with him. And I said at the time that, you know, I wasn't a fan of the streak ending, but it made sense. It made sense. And it built with that great moment at WrestleMania where Rollins had the Money in the Bank cash in. That will go down as one of the best WrestleMania endings of all time. So, you know, back then, it made sense to put the title on him. But now it's sort of the law of diminishing returns. Now it's going in the opposite direction where I think just by virtue of him holding that title and never defending it, it's actually been overtaken by the IC title in terms of value to the Raw brand. If they want to change that, you got to put the title on Rollins. And I think they could do so believably. Yes, Rollins is not as big and jacked as Brock is. Although, I don't know, lately, Lesnar has not looked all that jacked lately. He's kind of... Looks like he's taking a load off, but they can do it believably. Rollins has built a ton of goodwill with the audience. He's done so naturally and organically, and it just opens up the possibility of natural feuds with Dean Ambrose, who's going to be coming back soon, you know, coming out of SummerSlam. That could be a feud right there, especially if Ambrose were to come back as a heel instead of a babyface. Jason Jordan is due back any week now. He's got a history with Seth Rollins. Is it too early for him to be challenging for the championship? Maybe. I certainly wouldn't have him win it. But I also kind of want them to finish what they started between those two. So you can even do something by the end of the year with Rollins and Jordan. Even if it's just a one-time only pay-per-view match and Rollins wins and they move on, that's fine. But that's another possibility. Finn Balor is another name, right? Now, we've seen a lot of matches with him and Rollins. To do one more and this time have it be for the championship. You know, you've got the built-in story that Finn never did lose the title. He beat Seth for it, in fact. And then he got hurt. But in the process, he got hurt. He had to be stripped of the championship. So you can fall back on that story and have, do one pay-per-view match between them to sort of wrap up that feud. There's a lot of different names that Seth can work with on top as the champion, I think, going into the new year. The one that excites me the most, honestly, isn't any of the ones I mentioned. It's not Ambrose, it's not Jordan, it's not Balor, it's not Roman. It's Drew McIntyre, who, by the end of this year, he should break away from Dolph Ziggler and set out on his... I mean, I could see this coming from a mile away. Right now, these two are, right, they're tight, they're a tag team. And I like what they're doing right now, honestly, with Ziggler and McIntyre. I think Ziggler is benefiting from it more than anything because Ziggler was dead in the water. At least this is something for him to do and he can sort of play off this guy. But, you know, I see this getting to a point where, you know, in storyline, McIntyre realizes that I don't need this dead weight anymore. And he obviously unloads that dead weight and sets out on his own. And he could be a babyface, he could be a heel. Right now he's a heel, I think that's fine. I think McIntyre can play it either way, frankly. But the idea that we could potentially get a Seth Rollins, Drew McIntyre feud for the Universal Championship, I think that could be real good. And not only could it be real good, I think that could be the point that you put the title on McIntyre and give him a chance to run with it. So I look forward and I say to myself, not only who's the right person for that spot, but, you know, who's the right person to feud with all these different people coming out of SummerSlam if they pull the trigger at SummerSlam? And the answer is Seth Rollins. It's right in front of your face. The only question is, does WWE feel the same way? Is it right in front of Vince McMahon's face? Or is he blind? Can he not see this? We'll see. Hopefully the rumor is true. Hopefully they don't make the same mistake with Seth that they did with Roman by waiting too long. Ronda Rousey came out to watch Nia Jax dismantle a young lady named Michelle Webb. She played with her like a little kid picking the wings off a fly. It's completely ridiculous. It, you know, not 1 month ago, it hasn't even been a full month yet. Okay, we had to sit through that wretched promo, that backlash after Nia won her match against Alexa Bliss, where she got on the mic and she vomited out a bunch of scripted words. It just felt totally forced. Basically just plugging their anti-bullying campaign. Be a star! Be a star! This is for everyone who's ever been bullied. Who wants to be ordinary? Be extraordinary! It's a good thing I had a bucket next to me. It's not that the message is a bad message for kids, but just the way it was delivered, it was so phony. It was just so forced. It was such a fail. People were booing. It was awful. It was just a complete mess. But the reason I bring this up is, you know, I mean, I've seen guys go from babyface to heel, heel to babyface. Big Show made a career out of it. But to do what they did with Nia in the span of less than 4 weeks, where she came out as this big champion of anti-bullying, and this went on for weeks, right? And now you look at Nia now, and it's like there was no slow burn to any sort of, like, 180 degree turn. It just was like they snapped their fingers and all of a sudden Nia was back to being the heel bully. This company has quite the knack for storytelling, I must say. I prefer Nia this way as opposed to the way she was 4 weeks ago, but it's just jarring to see how she's portrayed now as compared to just a few weeks ago. It's like two different people. She taunted Ronda, told her to come on down, help out poor Michelle. She needs your help. Come to the ring. So Rousey came to the ring. She, with her mean face on, Nia made fun of her mean face, and she walked out. Kevin Owens pinned Bobby Roode. And here's another thing I wanted to talk about. Bobby Roode. You talk about not caring about somebody. Last week, I said Baron Corbin has go-away heat with me. I hate to say it, but Bobby Roode is almost in the same boat with Corbin now for me. People on Twitter this week were talking about a report. I have no idea where it originated. It could be complete BS, but this week's rumor was that Vince McMahon has soured on Bobby Roode because of poor crowd reactions to the guy. And I tweeted out, I said, you know what, he ain't the only one. And I was surprised by how many people actually agreed with me, very few people. There were some people who came to Roode's defense, oh, it's not his fault, it's in the booking. But for the most part, people seem to be in agreement with that sentiment that Bobby Roode just ain't cutting it right now on the main roster. He's not exactly lighting the world on fire. And I look at this, he comes out every week, he's got the song, the bell rings, and it's just, he has been dull as dishwater since getting to the main roster. Now, in NXT, yes, he was a heel, and he was far more entertaining in that role, but we also knew his motivation. He came out the moment he first walked out and cut that first promo on NXT television. He was wearing the suit. He talked about how much better he was and how he dressed better than everybody else. I'm richer than everybody else. I wear nicer clothes. I'm going to be the NXT champion, right? That whole shtick. That's more than we really know about him since he came to Raw, even when he came to SmackDown initially. He came to SmackDown, he was a babyface. It was like, huh, okay, well, that's kind of weird, but okay, we'll see how he does. And he never really did anything on that brand, got drafted over to Raw, and what has he done? What has he done? He's done nothing. Right now, he's got the theme song. He waves his arms around like he's trying to lift off, and he shouts glorious every few minutes. That's it. There's no depth to his character. His character has about as much depth as a kiddie pool. And yes, I do think that he is, you know, he's better as the villain, but I also understand you can't turn everybody heel, right? Sometimes people make fun. Oh, Solomon, you just want everybody to turn heel. You know what? I don't, but yes, it is kind of comical sometimes. I look back and I'm like, yeah, they should turn this guy, they should turn this. But I don't know. I think it goes to a bigger problem in this company. Maybe WWE is just that bad at booking babyfaces. If they did a better job of booking their babyfaces, maybe people wouldn't want to see everybody turn heel. I mean, they hit a home run with Braun Strowman. I mean, I will give them all the credit in the world for that. They have largely handled him very, very well. So it's not like they don't know how to book a good babyface. I don't think, though, that you can let Roode off the hook completely in this instance. He doesn't get a pass just because, you know, he's better as a heel. If they just turn him heel, everything would be great. If he was that good, he should be able to make this work right now. Right? It's not working. Whatever they're doing is not working. After the match, Strowman came down. He chased Kevin Owens around the ring. This was after Owens had already beaten Rude, which he pinned him right in the middle of the ring. Strowman came out, chased Owens around, laid him out. Rude, the whole time, he's celebrating like a heel. It's this really over-the-top, like, okay, this guy's going to get his ass kicked kind of thing. He's jumping up and down. He's waving his arms. Yeah, Braun, go Braun, right? You could see this coming from a mile away, what was about to happen. But it was the most entertained by him that I've been since he was drafted to Raw. He got up on the second rope. He was cheering on Strowman. Strowman kind of got sick of this. He grabbed Rude by the throat. He power slammed him, left him laying. I think they're having a match on Raw tomorrow night. There's something there. They just need to do a better job of bringing it out of him. But he also has to sort of pick up the slack too. You can't just throw everything on WWE. You know, these guys, I don't know, man. If they're that good, they should be able to make this work. And just whatever they're doing right now, whatever Rude is doing and they're giving him, it's just not working. So they've got to make some kind of a change. Maybe this was a seed that was planted to something different that they may do soon with Bobby Rude. But yeah, he's perilously close to entering Baron Corbin territory with me, which is something I never would have thought I would say, you know, when he was doing his thing in NXT. Sami Zayn and Bobby Lashley is official for Money in the Bank. I think the less said about these segments leading up to this, the better. They may have a good match. There's no reason for them not to. I mean, Sami is really good. Lashley can be really good. We haven't really seen him have the chance to yet since he's come back. I just think the build-up to this match has been total shit. So hopefully their match is better than the build-up to said match. We had the Women's Last Chance Money in the Bank Gauntlet match that headlined Raw this week. Not quite as long as the Gauntlet from a few months ago, but still a pretty long match. Sasha Banks, Bayley, Mickie James, Dana Brooke, Ruby Riott, Liv Morgan, and Sarah Logan. The right person won. I said it right here on the podcast last week. Sasha Banks should be the one going to Money in the Bank and filling that final spot. And she is. She came out last. She beat Ruby Riott with the bank statement. Ruby, though, I thought was the MVP of the match. She pinned Bayley. She pinned Dana Brooke, Mickie James. She was in there, I think, almost 20 minutes. She's been really, I've said this before, she's been really impressive since she came to the main roster. I just didn't see much there when she was in NXT, so I don't know if it's just, you know, now she's part of a faction that she's leading, or maybe now she's a heel and not a face. That goes back to the whole heel-face thing. I don't know exactly what it is, but she's a different person since coming to the main roster, and I've been really impressed, when I see her out there. But Sasha's the money player. In this match, she is the money player. I still think Natty is probably the one getting the briefcase, because of the whole Ronda tie-in, and they're probably going to do something there. But you can't have an 8-woman Money in the Bank match on pay-per-view and not have Sasha Banks in there. And she's been downplayed a lot lately. The feud with Bayley was DOA. Boy, did they bungle that feud. And they may not be done with it. Just because they've sort of, it feels like they've gotten away from it a little bit, doesn't mean that it's over, right? They could still come back to it. But they completely screwed it up. I don't know anybody who is waiting with bated breath to see how this feud is going to play out. I would be perfectly fine if they just dropped the whole thing and had Bayley go her way and had Sasha go her way. So Sasha's been downplayed a lot lately. People, oh, she's been buried. Not buried, but, you know, they've downplayed her a lot. It's time to change that, because she still is one of the most popular performers they have on that roster. She still is one of the best that they have on that roster. And she's certainly better than what they've had her doing. So it's about time they put her back in, a prime spot, which now she's in. And, you know, again, you can't have an 8-woman Money in the Bank match without Sasha, without Charlotte, Becky. They're all in there. Bayley, unfortunately for her, is the odd woman out. But Bayley's been cold for a while now. You know, it looks like they, I don't know if it's dropped. I don't know if the feud with Sasha is on hold. If they're going to kiss and make up and forget that it all ever happened. I don't know what their plans are for that. I don't know if they know what their plans are for that. But I know this, there was no interaction whatsoever between the two of them in this match. I thought maybe Sasha would be first and Bayley would be second and they would go at it for a while and have a match. They didn't do that. So I don't know what their plans are with the two of them. But the right person won. SmackDown Live was from Raleigh, North Carolina this past week. I like SmackDown a lot better than I like Raw. Not a lot happened outside of the main event, but the dance-off, which I was dreading, between Lana and Naomi, I thought was entertaining for what it was. And I thought the six-man tag with New Day against The Miz and The Bar was excellent. That was a really fun match. What I did not like the bait-and-switch on the Samoa Joe Daniel Bryan singles match, which could be a pay-per-view match, yes, but they still promoted it all week for this show, and then they shoehorn Big Cass in there. I mean, that's like thinking you're being set up on a date with Katrina from Lucha Underground. You get all dressed up, you buy flowers, you go, you ring the doorbell, and the door swings open, and it's Moolah. You know, like, this is not what I signed up for. But we did still get to see Brian and Joe. They were in the ring, they wrestled, and the match turned out to be pretty good. I said last week, I didn't totally buy this idea. I said, beware. I said, beware of these reports that Cass is you know, injured again, or he may be having ACL surgery again. I wasn't convinced that he was legitimately hurt. I figured, what I thought would happen is that he would interfere in the match. So we would get a match on TV between Joe and Brian, but it wouldn't have a clean winner. Cass would interfere. He would cost Brian the match. Joe would go to Money in the Bank, and we would end up with a rematch between Cass and Brian at the pay-per-view. I was not far off. Joe did win. He put Brian to sleep in the Coquina Clutch to claim the final spot in that men's Money in the Bank match, and it is now official. According to Twitter, where all news is broken now, it is now official that we are getting Daniel Bryan versus Big Cass at Money in the Bank. And they're trying to get the young guy over. They want him to work with Bryan. They're trying to get him over. I don't know if he has it or not. I don't see it in him yet. But there's no better person, I think, for Cass to be working with than Daniel Bryan. Bryan does not need to be in the ladder match. He can be doing something lesser on the show, like Roman Reigns. He's doing something lesser, right? He's not in the ladder match. He's wrestling Jinder Mahal. For Roman Reigns, that's a lesser role on the show. And we both know that both guys, Bryan probably and Reigns, will end up in big matches anyway at SummerSlam, so it doesn't even matter. Not challenging AJ for the WWE Championship. If I'm looking ahead to SummerSlam, I'm just looking ahead for roles for Daniel Bryan in August. If he's not challenging AJ for the championship, I don't think he is, I would probably go with Samoa Joe in that spot, by the way, against AJ for the WWE title, assuming that AJ is still champion at that point. I like the idea of Styles and Joe for the championship. But there is no shortage of opponents for Daniel Bryan at SummerSlam. You know, Shinsuke Nakamura being the obvious one. The Miz being another, although I would hold off on that probably until WrestleMania. If they were going to have Bryan work with a newer guy on that show and sort of help put him over, I would much rather they go with Andrade Cien Almas than Big Cass. You know, now Almas just debuted on SmackDown. They weren't going to put him right into a feud with Daniel Bryan. I'm not saying that, you know, they made the wrong choice for the month of June. But if they were going to put him in there with somebody new in August, it should be Almas. And this Cass thing, hopefully by then, is a thing of the past. And hey, I hope it works out for him and maybe he'll get over as a big star. But I look at Andrade and I say, you're looking at a guy who you want to get over and has the potential to be a champion or a top star on this brand. You go with Almas. You don't go with Cass. You don't go with Corbin like on Raw. You go with Almas. You know, because the Almas-Zelina Vega combo is a winning combo. I don't know that SummerSlam would be too soon to do that match with Almas and Bryan. I think that would actually be perfectly acceptable by then. He will have been around for a few months. So they have a lot. The point is with Bryan, they have a lot of options. Whether it's AJ, Joe, Nakamura, Almas, they have options for the guy. But we all have to remember one very important thing with Daniel Bryan, because we still don't have an answer on this. We don't know if Bryan has signed a new deal with WWE. I don't believe he has. I have not heard anything definitively saying that Daniel Bryan has signed a new contract with WWE. If not, that means that his deal, I believe, would be expiring sometime in September. And I don't think it's a guarantee that he's staying in this company. Now, if you said to me, you have to make a choice, do you think he's staying or do you think he's leaving? I think he'll stay. I think in the end he will stay. and they'll make a big play to make sure that they can keep him under contract. Maybe he'll make some demands and say, look, if I'm going to re-sign with you, I want some assurances that you're not just going to put me on the shelf if I get a little cut on my head. So it may be a back-and-forth negotiation like that. I don't know. But in the end, I think he'll stay. But he could very well leave. It's also very possible that he says, look, I don't need this. I like working the indies. I was kind of looking forward to going back and working on the indies and working with all these new people I've never worked with before, having the freedom to do what I want, and I don't have to worry about doctors telling me I can't wrestle. So this could go either way. And look, if he wants to work indies again, if he's afraid the WWE is going to screw him over again, he could very well walk out. If he has a bucket list of things that he would like to do before he retires, if there's, let's say, certain people in New Japan, or if there's certain people in Mexico that he'd like to work with before he retires, what is he now, 36, 37? He's not getting any younger. If he signs a contract, it probably would be, you got to figure it, probably they want at least a 3-year deal out of him. He'd be 40 at that point. It's now or never. If he has a list of things he'd like to do, it's probably now or never, right? And if WWE thinks that he may walk out after SummerSlam, then I think someone like Almas would be the perfect opponent for him to put over on his way out. They're not going to put Bryan in a championship match at SummerSlam if they think he may leave. So a lot of what they're doing with him now, I think, is also driven by maybe an uncertainty about what his future may be in that company. We have to just keep that in mind. It may not be, oh, they're trying to screw him, they're trying to bury him, why are they booking him this way? That probably has as much to do with it as anything, if he hasn't signed a new contract. But I think Almas, especially if he is going to leave, I think Almas would be the perfect opponent for him. Him putting over, let's say, Nakamura on his way out is far less valuable than him putting over somebody who really needs it, and that would be a huge win. And a huge credibility boost, I think, for Andrade to get a clean win over Daniel Bryan at SummerSlam. You know, that could really elevate him, I think, to the next level on that SmackDown brand. So let's just not forget that his contract status is still up in the air, and I think that's going to dictate how WWE books him this summer more than anything else. I like the Nakamura-Ty Dillinger match, especially the way the crowd reacted. Dillinger at one point mocked Nakamura. How Nakamura does the whole, come on! And Dillinger sort of mocked him with it, and the crowd came alive. Dillinger's really good. He's not like a top guy or anything like that, but he's a perfectly fine mid-carder, I think, who should be doing a lot more than he's doing right now on that show, so I'd like to see more of him. I actually thought Lana, in this dance-off segment that I was dreading, I thought Lana was better than Naomi. I know Naomi is the professional dancer and all that, and she looked, hey, don't get me wrong, she looked great, but I actually thought Lana won the competition. And this is coming from somebody, by the way, I admit, I once said Lana's dancing. I've seen people with vertigo and two broken legs with better dance moves than Lana. Remember when she first debuted that gimmick? She was a horrible dancer. I can only hope it was on purpose. But she was pretty good here. But she then gave Naomi a rude awakening, neck breaker, slapped Jimmy Uso, which 15 years ago would have gotten her a Samoan splash. But instead, the Usos took out Rusev and Aiden English, who were in the ring. Rusev was filming his wife. Don't get too excited. He was filming her dancing. This Tuesday, it's going to be Jimmy and Naomi against Aiden and Lana. The New Day beat The Bar and The Miz. Oh, Jesus Christ, these names. I read that out loud. The Bar and The Miz. You know, I miss the days of Axe and Smash, Hawk and Animal, you know, Legion of Doom, Natural Disasters, Nasty Boy. Like, those are cool names. Now we have The New Day, The Bar, The Miz. No wonder nobody really comes off as cool on this show anymore. But I will say, as much as I despise all this pancake nonsense with New, I love pancakes. I do. Pancakes over waffles all day, all night. Don't even try to argue with me because you're wrong. As much as I love pancakes, it's easy to forget how good New Day really is in the ring because they do all this other nonsense with the cereal and the pancakes and all that kind of crap. And the kids eat it up, you know, literally. They I guess, eat that stuff up and that's fine. But they're really good. And you kind of forget about that, I think, sometimes. And you know, the matches with the Usos last year, matches like this, when you drop the comedy shtick for a few minutes, you remember how good these guys really are. Big E hit the big ending on The Miz for the win. All three members of New Day looked up at the Money in the Bank briefcase. And they tease which one of them is actually going to be entering the Money in the Bank match. We still don't know. I got an email from a listener, Travis, in Pennsylvania, sort of calling me out for being what he felt was very dismissive last week of Xavier Woods when I was talking about which New Day members should be in the Money in the Bank match. I said Big E or Kofi, and you know, he pointed out that Woods sort of gets lost in the conversation and how he, you know, he thinks Woods is better than either one of those guys on the microphone, and he's, you know, right in there with them as far as in ring work. And he thinks that all of that can translate for Xavier into a very successful singles run. And he's right. I was being very dismissive of Xavier Woods, and he could very well end up being in that Money in the Bank match, because I think most people probably assume it's going to be Big E, or if it's not Big E, it's going to be Kofi. So maybe they'll swerve us. The thing with me, though, is I just don't see Woods, as good as he is, I don't see Woods ever being pushed at the level of WWE champion. I don't see him as being WWE champion. And I don't see them ever pushing him at the level of being WWE champion. Him having the briefcase, if he was to actually win it, would be a complete waste in that regard. I just don't see him being taken seriously at that level. And it doesn't mean that he can't have a successful run as U.S. champion. I think he absolutely could. But as far as WWE champion, I don't see it. Now, Kofi, though, you know, Woods himself has said in interviews recently, it's his personal goal to one day see Kofi Kingston, you know, wearing the WWE title. And Big E has said the same thing. They think he deserves it. And it could be a great story to tell. You know, Kofi has been in the company for so long, and he's been taken for granted. And now finally he's getting a shot at the big championship. It could be a fun story to tell. But I look at the talent on that SmackDown roster right now, and I don't see room for Kofi on top as WWE champion. I mean, again, I just don't see it. He could win the briefcase and he could tease a cash-in for the next 6 or 9 months. Maybe they even do a gimmick where any member of New Day can cash in at any given moment. So people have asked me, do you think if New Day wins the Money in the Bank match and they win the championship, one of them, you know, wins the title, that they could do the Freebird rule where all three of them could defend the WWE title? The answer is no. I don't think they will. I don't think they should. I don't want to see that. But they could do the Freebird rule with the briefcase. So you have one member of New Day 1 week come out and kind of threaten to cash in. And then either it fails, or not that it fails, but like they don't cash in. And then maybe a couple of weeks later, a different member of New Day tries to cash in. Like, so you could do the Freebird thing with the briefcase. I wouldn't do it with the world title. But my point is, you look at the SmackDown roster the way it is right now, with all the top talent they have on there right now, and you've got, you know, the Bryan Miz story, which I guess, you know, it doesn't need the championship, but I think it would mean more to have Miz be the one that, you know, Bryan ultimately beats to win the title back if he stays and if he does get the championship back. But with all the names they have on their roster, I don't see room for New Day in the WWE title picture. Joe, Bryan, and Cass in a triple threat match ended the show. Like I said, Joe picked up the win. He gets the final spot in the Money in the Bank match. Cass laid out Bryan with a big boot to end the show. I hope their next match is better than the first one, because that first match left a lot to be desired, to say the least. This week, coming up on Tuesday, we get Charlotte versus Becky Lynch. And they're in Corpus Christi, Texas. Uh-oh. Bring a pillow. A lot of you had tweeted me and said you really need to watch 205 Live this week, and I have not been able to catch it a lot lately, but I went out of my way to make sure I did watch the Cedric Alexander, Buddy Murphy cruiserweight title match this week, and I'm glad I did, because it was the best WWE match all week. I think it probably will go down as one of the best WWE matches of the year. Not the match of the year, but it'll be on the list. Murphy is just a changed man from his days in NXT. As impressive as he is in the ring, I do think he would still benefit once he hits Raw or SmackDown from having somebody talking for him. Or just like being paired off with somebody to play off of. Because I know the two of them are an item. And because they were together in NXT, my first thought is Alexa Bliss. I think Alexa Bliss would be the perfect person to pair him off with when he does make that transition. But we may still be a ways off from that, so who knows when that may be. Right now, 205 Live has been very good to Murphy. Triple H, let's be honest, Triple H has been very good to Murphy. If Vince McMahon was still running this show, I doubt that Buddy Murphy would be in the position that he is in right now. Cedric, we know Cedric is really good. That's not a secret. He was wrestling here in his home state on this show, which does not always work out well for these WWE guys when they wrestle in their hometown or their home state. But it did for Alexander. He retained the championship with the lumbar check. He celebrated with his family at ringside. Nice little feel-good moment when the match was over. You could tell a lot of people left when SmackDown ended. I assume it's pretty much like that every week with 205 Live. But the people who stuck around, at least this week, they were way more vocal than I remember a lot of those 205 Live crowds being, and even just a few months ago. Maybe it was the home state thing for Cedric, they were really into it, but as the match built, it helped. Like, it helped that they were really into the match. But the match itself, if you didn't see it, it's worth going out of your way. Take 20, 25 minutes. It's a long match, but it's worth taking those 25 minutes, setting them aside, and watching it. They told a good story. You know, Murphy was working over Cedric's back for a good part of the match. He fought back lots of near falls, which, look, you know, the near falls, the knee strikes, the slaps and the kicks to the head, we see a lot of that stuff these days, probably more than we should, but these two made it work. It felt like a real war, you know, that these two guys were involved in. Murphy lost, but he is one of the big winners of this new rebooted 205 Live since Triple H took over, because you know, from what I've seen of him, everything I've seen of him since he was, I guess, called up, you could say, he's looked great. The only thing I would, you know, if I had one critique, I would love it if they dropped the Buddy name because it makes him sound like a dog. And if they just called him like Madman Murphy or something like that before he hits either Raw or SmackDown. They have time. If they want to make a change, they could still change the name. But, you know, he's good. Look, he's good enough that the name won't kill him. Only the dreaded creative has nothing for you could possibly kill this man. And if they can't come up with something for this guy, then frankly, they're just not very good at their jobs, because I just came up with two different ideas on what to do with him in the last 3 minutes between, you know, pairing him off with somebody like an Alexa Bliss, or again, I even suggested a name change. I mean, there's certain little, tweaks that you can make, I think, for when he's, you know, called up. If they can't come up with something themselves, then they got trouble. If I can do it, they can do it. One more piece of news. The return that nobody asked for may be happening. Former WCW World Heavyweight Champion David Arquette went on the Wendy Williams Show this week. That may be the weirdest sentence I've uttered on this podcast since the judge and the lawyers were arguing about Kane during the Punk trial, so probably the weirdest sentence in about an hour since I talked about that earlier. But he announced his return to professional wrestling. He has been training for an in-ring return for a while now under a new persona, David Magic Man Arquette. Perhaps he can make himself disappear. He said, for 18 years since winning the WCW title, he has been attacked and he has been trolled on the internet, and he is ready to bring some respect back to his name. And to be fair to David Arquette, as the story goes, he knew that it was a horrible idea at the time to put the championship on him. He was against it. He didn't want to do it initially, but he went along with it anyway. He decided just to do it, have fun with it. And he actually donated all of the money that he made from his WCW run to the widows of Brian Pillman and Owen Hart. For that alone, Arquette is a class guy in my book. And part of it, look, part of this is just me being silly. You know, I don't hate the guy or anything. If he wants to come back and he wants to wrestle some indie matches, if he's training for it, if he's taking it seriously, more power to him. It looks like he may have found his first opponent, Human Tornado, who is sort of a blast from the past in a lot of ways. He was a big time name on the indie scene many years ago, particularly out on the West Coast. Super talented guy. It's a shame he never hit it big, because a lot of the names he worked with out west, you know, all those years ago, have gone on to great fame in WWE, NXT, TNA, and other promotions. And you never really heard, you know, after a while, you just stop hearing about Human Tornado. And I hadn't even thought about him probably in ages until I saw his name pop up this week, because he is about to retire. He's about to hang it up and call it quits. He's had back problems for a very long time, stemming from an operation that he had many years ago. He had a changes in ring style as a result. Now he's, apparently he has a lump. I don't know if the lump is on his back or what part of the body it might be on. Maybe, CM Punk's lump jumped from Punk to Human Tornado. I don't know, but, doctors have told him not to wrestle until they figure out what the lump is and what's causing it. So he has decided to retire from the ring, and his last match is going to be at the next Gathering of the Juggalos that the Insane Clown Posse does every single year. And he decided, he saw David Arquette's coming back, he decided to go on Twitter and throw down the gauntlet to Magic Man Arquette, and to his surprise, Arquette accepted. Now, when I say he accepted, he just wrote back a tweet saying, I'm down. who knows if he was being serious or not. But it sounds like Human Tornado versus David Arquette at the Gathering of the Juggalos might actually become a thing here in 2018.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
NXT this week opened with the NXT champion, Aleister Black, who has sort of felt like an afterthought in a lot of ways since he won that championship. I think a lot of the focus has been on Gargano and Ciampa and, you know, even Undisputed Era and all these other things that are going on. And Aleister just sort of feels like an afterthought. So this is the first time we've seen him, I feel like, in a few weeks. He came out, he was talking for a little bit, he was interrupted by Lars Sullivan, who said that William Regal, who apparently is dealing with some sort of a medical issue, and hopefully, you know, best wishes to him, hopefully it's not too serious, but he claimed that Regal has granted him the next opportunity at the NXT Championship. He is now the number one contender. He will challenge Aleister Black for the title at TakeOver Chicago, and he laid out Aleister with his freak accident finish. So that match is now official for the next TakeOver show. Another War Raiders squash win here on this show. They showed off some more of their offense here. Some moves that we haven't seen them do before. They look good. This is like the way they used to build new stars and new teams on those old superstars in wrestling challenge shows, or, you know, NWA Saturday Night and all those programs. That was routine. You know, that you would have new acts come in and you would put them in there with basically scrubs, to let them show off their offense and give them a few months to get over. And, you know, back in the day, you'd have a team like these guys come in, they'd be squashing people left and right for 2-3 months, you know, before they finally handed them some legit competition. EC3 beat Fabian Aichner. Midway through this match, Johnny Gargano very randomly walked out through the crowd. He walked over to the announce table, grabbed the microphone. He had a contract in hand. It was a contract for his street fight with Tommaso Ciampa at TakeOver Chicago. He said that he has signed it. He let everybody know the match is now official. And he left right in the middle of this match. He just walked out and made his announcement, and he walked right back out after that. I'm not sure why this couldn't wait until after the match. I thought this was very disrespectful of EC3. How dare this man? EC3 looked kind of bewildered by the whole thing. And I would not at all be surprised if EC3 ends up costing him his match with Ciampa in Chicago. Now to kickstart that feud and maybe set up EC3 as a heel. I mean, he already carries himself like a heel. Maybe this is just sort of a way to set up the eventual program between the two of them and make it very clear that he is one. Because, look, and it, by the way, if it is, it's smart, because you put anybody in there against Johnny Gargano, I don't care who you are, you're going to be the heel. So whether you want them to be or not. But I thought to myself, this has to serve some other purpose. Now, maybe the purpose it serves is just to get a match between EC3 and Johnny Gargano next week or the week after, because we still have a few weeks until TakeOver. But if this really doesn't get addressed much between now and then, I wonder if maybe it's a sign that EC3 may stick his nose in that match. Ciampa now can get a big win since he lost the first match, and it could be a way to transition those two guys away from each other, and maybe they do something with Gargano and EC3. You know, everything, typically on this show, everything, even down to something as sort of minor as this, serves some kind of a purpose. So I'm sure it's leading to a match at some point between the two of them. Let's not forget one thing that happened during this match that I think is easy to sort of overlook. And that is that awesome springboard crossbody to the floor that Fabian Aichner hit during this match. Aichner is no small man, even though he was in the Cruiserweight Classic. Even when he was in the Cruiserweight Classic, and technically everybody was supposed to be 205 and under, he didn't look 205. He looked like a big dude compared to everybody else. Now I know he's over the 205, you know, weight limit, and he's a big guy. And to see him in there doing moves, and this is not the first time we've seen him do springboard-type moves and flips, and it's very impressive, you know, watching it come from a guy like this. I've been more impressed, honestly, by Fabian Aichner when I see him. He loses all of his matches, but I've been more impressed by him than I have, say, you know, somebody like Cesar Bonanni, who is another, you know, also, you know, young guy. He's a tall guy, and obviously they have high hopes for him, but I've been more impressed by Aichner, you know, than I have, Bonanni. A few times they've trotted him out there. I think Aichner is the real deal. They aired a great video package on Bianca Belair, showing all of her athletic achievements as a child, track and field, all the different sports that she played, and she got into CrossFit and all these things. She graduated college with not one but two degrees, but then was bored by what she basically called her normal life. And when she found out about wrestling, she knew she had found her passion. That was basically the gist of the video. Very well done. Then came Ricochet. My oh my. What can I say about Ricochet? Ricochet went one-on-one against Chris Dijak. Donovan Dijak from Ring of Honor made his NXT television debut here. Got a little bit of offense in. And he had this one... I think Ricochet went for a dive outside, and Dijak caught him and basically gave him a choke slam on the apron. And he went for a springboard moonsault, unfortunately for Dijak. He crashed and burned, nobody home. Ricochet hit... Now, this to me was the most impressive part of this match. Not the segment. This was the second most impressive part of the entire segment. I'll get to the first part in a second, but the Ricochet show here. So... Dijak is a big dude. I don't know offhand. I don't have it written down what his height is. If I had to take a guess, I would say, Dijak has got to be every bit of 6'4", 6'5". He's a big dude, okay? And, you know, when you're big like that, you're heavier. Ricochet is not a terribly big person. He gave Dijak a deadlift suplex from, you know, we see sometimes guys coming out of a suplex. They continue the roll through, and we see Rollins do this. We see Rollins do this routinely when he does those superplexes off the top. He'll roll through, he'll suplex the guy. I don't know that I've ever seen Seth Rollins do that with somebody, let's say, like Brock Lesnar, right? Or Braun Strowman, or anybody terribly large. Ricochet, coming out of a move like that, he gave Dijak a deadlift standing vertical suplex. He wasn't completely vertical, but he got him up enough. He got a standing ovation for this. This guy is obscenely strong. And then he hit the 630 off the top rope, a la Prince Puma, and got the win. So, yeah, this is kind of a pattern that they've done before. They'll debut guys, including guys that, like, the fans in Full Sail would know. But if it's their first match, you know they're going to lose. Right, and that's fine. I thought Dijak, for the few minutes he was in there, looked fine. He's got a lot of potential to be one of the big stars on that brand. But it was all about Ricochet, right? That was very impressive. So Ricochet gets on the mic after the match is over, and he's talking about the Velveteen Dream. He's not very happy that Velveteen Dream turned on him. Last time we saw them, they were teaming up against Lars Sullivan, and there was a little bit of a miscommunication between the two of them, and the Dream turned on Ricochet. So Ricochet is none too happy about that. And this brought out the Velveteen Dream, who John Cena this past week said is the one guy in NXT he looks at who has the potential he thinks to be a really big star, or could be the next big breakout star. And it's tough to argue that. I mean, I don't know the Velveteen Dream is going to be on the level of a Cena or a Roman Reigns as like the pushed guy in the company. But as far as being a big star, there's no reason to think he won't be. I mean, he's been one of the bright spots of NXT for a while now. And, you know, we've really seen him in two I guess, two high-profile feuds. The main one being Aleister Black. They had their match at TakeOver all those months ago, and it was one of the best matches all year. That match was, it was incredible, right? And even the build-up to it, right on down to when Aleister beat him and finally said his name. I just loved every single thing they did with that whole program between those two. And so now I find myself once again, like, completely engaged in what they're doing here with Ricochet and Velveteen Dream. And he has a lot to do with that. So I don't disagree with John Cena at all as far as the potential that this guy has. So he comes out. I don't even know what he's wearing. He's wearing just the wackiest thing. And he comes out and he's talking about, he says, look, anything that you can do, anything Ricochet can do, I can do better. He repeats that a few times. Ricochet is challenging him. He keeps calling him like homeboy. He wants him to come into the ring. And Dream teased going into the ring, and then he had a change of heart, so he backed up a little bit. So now you got to look. He's about halfway up the aisleway. Yeah, they have that little ramp in NXT. He's about halfway down the ramp. Okay? He's keeping his distance between himself and Ricochet. But he tells Ricochet, again, anything you can do, I can do better. So what does Ricochet do? Ricochet decides to call him out on his shit. He does a running flip dive out of the ring and lands on his feet. He sticks the landing and very calmly, very casually walks a few more feet right up to the Velveteen Dream. And what did he say on the mic? I was like so amazed by what he said. I almost don't even remember what he said on the mic. It was like, try me or show me or something like that. But all I know is I was in awe when I saw it. And I saw the GIF before I even saw the show. I kind of regret that because everybody was tweeting out these you know, the GIFs on Twitter of him doing the dive out of the ring. And then I went back and I watched the whole segment. But my mouth was open. And Velveteen Dream sold this perfectly. He stood there like he had seen a ghost. He was standing there. He couldn't believe what he just saw. His mouth was agape. He didn't know what to say. He didn't know how to react. And Ricochet just stood there. Everybody is standing up. They're giving him a standing ovation. And that was it. That was the whole segment. But Ricochet is a freak of nature. I said on Twitter, I said, my knee hurts. When I first saw, and I have a knee that hurts, so, you know, but even if I didn't have a bum wheel right now, I think both my knees would be hurting just watching that. He's not going to be able to do that forever, so for the time being, it is cool, you know, when he's able to pull off stuff like that, because he's able to do things that nobody else can do. And this is the first time that there's a lot of people who watch only WWE or watch only NXT who maybe have never seen a Ricochet match before. They don't know much about the guy. Maybe they didn't see him, you know, Prince Puma and Lucha Underground. And that's got to be really cool for those people that have never really seen this guy before to see him doing some of this stuff. You know, there's no wonder that, you know, people say, oh, you know, Ricochet, why is he not in WWE? All these years, why is he not in WWE? This guy is a major star in the making. And now he's finally here, and you see why. And you'll have people who say, oh, it's that flippy shit. You know what? A little bit of flippy shit is fine. Ricochet, I think, is the one guy who you can almost excuse it with, because he's able to do things that nobody else... He's able to do flippy things that nobody else can do, but he's also a really good wrestler. You put the two of them together, you have a major star. It would be very hard for WWE to fuck up Ricochet. They already have done well. They kept the name. His very first match, right? That big showcase for him at TakeOver in the ladder match. Now he's going into a feud with Velveteen Dream, who's one of the hottest stars on that brand in NXT. So far, so good. Triple H is doing very well by Ricochet so far. I have the same fears that a lot of you probably have. When he eventually gets called up, what will happen? I think he'll be fine. I think he'll be fine. But so far they've done very well by Ricochet. And I think it would be very, very, very hard, but not impossible, for this company to fuck this guy up. But he's got to be careful, because he could fuck up his own knee. You know, one bad landing and he could be out for 9 months. So hopefully hopefully we don't see too much of that, but this was incredible. I echo what everybody else has said about this. This was an amazing thing to see. We had Shayna Baszler and Dakota Kai in the main event for the NXT Women's Championship. Baszler just played with Kai for a good part of the match, and Dakota fought back. She hit a couple of really impressive, like, super speed running kicks into the corner on Baszler, but in the end, it was Shayna Baszler locking in the choke, getting the tap out. I like, you know, when Baszler takes someone's arm or their knee, like she did with Dakota here in this match, and she sort of, she sets it up a certain way and then stomps on it repeatedly. It just looks cool. She did that here with Dakota's leg. She was really stomping on that thing, making you think like she's, you know, breaking the leg, breaking the ankle. But like I said, Dakota fought back. In the end, it wasn't enough. And Baszler gets the win. Of course, the bully that she is, she's not finished. So she locks her back in the choke when the match is over. And who should come out to make the save but Nikki Cross, who now is getting more television time than the rest of Sanity because Sanity was, quote, called up. And somebody forgot to put them on TV. So technically they're on SmackDown now. They're on the SmackDown roster page if you go to WWE.com. But they have yet to debut on TV. So Nikki Cross now is all by herself. And she comes out and she's ranting and raving. She's like a female version of the Tasmanian devil. You don't know, you know, she's just out of her mind. And she grabs the championship from Shayna Baszler. And she's basically telling Dakota Kai, I want you to be the referee. And I want to have a championship match with you right now, she tells Shayna Baszler. And, you know, Baszler comes in and she lays her out and Dakota Kai does the three count. Of course, none of this is official, but she celebrates, does Nikki Cross when the show is over with the championship. So that will obviously be the match at TakeOver. I don't see any reason for Dakota Kai to be involved here. She got beat. So I have to assume the match at TakeOver will be Nikki Cross one-on-one with Shayna Baszler. And I think Nikki is a fine interim opponent for Shayna to beat, so I have no issue with that. I'm always down to watch Nikki Cross in a high profile position on the show. I like Nikki Cross, and that was NXT. So I think the build to TakeOver has been fun, and I am very much looking forward not only to Gargano and Ciampa, but I'm very much looking forward to what they do with Ricochet and the Velveteen Dream. If it's anything like the program that Dream had with Aleister Black, this should end up being a lot of fun. I guess the question is this, you know, I don't know if he'll win, I don't know if he'll lose, but coming out of this, I guess the question is, what do you do with Velveteen Dream? You know, can you hold off long enough without sort of killing whatever steam he has before you put him in a match or a program for the championship? Because now Aleister Black is the champion. Now, I don't know how long he'll hold on to that title. But let's say, you know, he gets past Lars Sullivan. And let's say Velveteen Dream beats Ricochet at TakeOver, which, you know, I wouldn't have an issue with. I don't really have an issue with either one of those guys winning or losing, as long as they go out there and have a great match. But let's say he wins. Could we be setting up an NXT Championship match for Brooklyn in August between Aleister Black and the Velveteen Dream, almost a year after their first match? I'd be down for that. But on the other hand, you've got Ricochet, you've got Adam Cole. Now Adam Cole has his own championship, but you know, there are other options as far as what to do. But I, now that I kind of say it out loud, I really like that idea. You know, the Velveteen Dream, he kind of needs a big win, right? We haven't really seen him get a big, big win yet. Even the feud with Black, he was the loser. Ricochet would not be hurt by losing, I don't think, to the Velveteen Dream. So why not give Dream a big win and set him up for a rematch with Aleister in August? I'd be down for that. Let's get to your mailbag questions. If you have a question to send into the show, you may do so. TheSolomonster@gmail.com. Oh, hey, I forgot to mention this earlier. Us Weekly, now in this on-again, off-again, on-again, off-again cycle of news that I know most of you probably could not possibly care any less about. But Us Weekly now claims that John Cena and Nikki Bella are back together. Their little stunt has not paid off, though, as the most recent episode of Total Bellas did the lowest audience in the history of the show. Just over 500,000 viewers. Well done! Well done. What other gimmicks can they come up with to boost next season? We should start coming up with ideas now. But again, if you have questions for the mailbag, thesolomonster@gmail.com, please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Buddy from Roswell, New Mexico. Buddy's not going to be very happy about that comment I made earlier, I guess, when I said I pitched changing Buddy Murphy's name to Madman Murphy because Buddy sounds too much like a dog's name. So I don't have anything against anybody named Buddy. You know, Buddy Love, right, from the Nutty Professor. I just think as a wrestler name, it's not very intimidating. That's all I meant. So I love Buddy. What is your opinion on Cody facing Nick Aldis for the NWA World Championship at the All In show? I think it is smart business for Billy Corgan in the NWA. This will be the highest profile NWA title defense since he took over and effectively rebooted things. All In is a big show. This puts the NWA title front and center on it, so it is very smart. You have the story of Cody, if they want to tell this story. You have the story of Cody challenging for the title that his father once held. And you could argue semantics and say, look, it's not really the championship that his father held, but, you know, it looks the same, right? It's called the NWA title. Visually, it's the same title. You could tell that story if you want to. They added a little wrinkle recently by having Aldis say that if Cody regains the Ring of Honor world title, June 29th at the company's Best in the World show, he's going to be in a triple threat match with the champion, Dalton Castle, and Marty Scurll. And Aldis said that, look, if you win back that ROH title, then our match at All In, I want it to be champion versus champion, title for title. Truly make it an all-in match, which to me sounds like a giveaway that Cody is going to win that belt back on the 29th. I could be wrong. It does seem to me like Dalton Castle's run as the Ring of Honor champion has been very underwhelming. I know he's been hampered by a bad back for a while now. He's had back issues that have plagued him. I'm sure it has, you know, at least something to do with his run being somewhat underwhelming. I also think, frankly, they probably waited too long to put the title on him. I feel like Castle was just a really hot act for Ring of Honor that probably peaked a while ago. And by the time they finally put that championship on him, it probably was a little too late. I also think part of it may be that he's been playing second fiddle to Cody and the Bucks and the Bullet Club, right? The Bullet Club and the New Japan contingent, like, he's got... I feel like Dalton Castle has one of those Chris Jericho WWE title runs going for him right now, which is not a good thing. And Ring of Honor business, you know, has been good with those guys, but I think it's come, you know, featuring all those other guys on top, I think, has probably come at the expense, to some degree, of Dalton Castle. The reality is, you know, Cody is going to be the hot act going into that All-In show on September 1st. You know, at least until then, it's going to be the talk of the town, and he's going to be, you know, a big name going into that show. And so why not put the Ring of Honor title back on him, even if it's only for a few months? Why not? And if I'm the NWA, you know, having my title on Cody also doesn't sound like a bad idea. That may not be possible contractually. I know Cody signed an exclusive deal last year with Ring of Honor, makes Ring of Honor his home base here in the U.S., he can still wrestle for New Japan, but I don't know how that would work if the NWA wanted to put their title on him. But, you know, maybe it's better to have all of these questions sort of hanging out there. We don't have answers. We don't know for sure, right? Maybe it's better that way. That way they keep people guessing. But I think the match makes for a nice attraction. I don't see it as the main event. I mean, me personally, I just don't see that as the main event of All In, not with some of the other talent. Some of those New Japan guys and Kenny Omega, and I feel like we probably still have yet to know or to find out what the true main event is going to be for this show, but I think as an attraction, it makes for a very nice attraction on that show. Sam from Corby, UK. With SmackDown's new deal and being on a new network, could this be a chance for Fox to make SmackDown look and feel different from Monday Night Raw? SmackDown should look and feel different from Monday Night Raw. I mean, it does in that Raw is red, SmackDown is blue. Okay, so that's one difference. But by and large, it all looks the same. All WWE programming looks the same, aside from NXT, because NXT is in a smaller venue that only fits about, I think, maybe 500 people. But I wish they would make it look like radically different. I've said this for so long. You know, they have their multi-million dollar HD set with all the LED lights and everything, and it can change and it can conform, and they can put logos up there and pay-per-view posters, and that's cool. But it's still the same set, right? The stage and the set is still largely the same. There really is no radical difference in look. If you watch Raw on Monday or when you watch SmackDown on Tuesday, they largely look like the same show. And while I wish they would make it look radically different, the fact is that's not what Fox paid $1 billion for. They paid all that money for SmackDown just the way it is. I don't think that, I haven't heard that Rupert Murdoch said, let's make a deal for SmackDown, but let's make a pinky swear. You're going to change the set and you're going to change this and that. No, they paid all that money for SmackDown just the way it is. I don't think they paid to radically change the show. I'm sure it'll get new music and they'll get new graphics and probably pyro. I mean, they have no excuse now not to have pyro. But I doubt, honestly, that the show looks much different than Raw does, because that's not what Fox is paying for. It's like the notion that we could all as fans find faults with WWE programming, right? All of us can. I do on this show every week. It's, you know, the show is not perfect. There's no such thing as a perfect show. It has its flaws, it has its faults, and we all wish that they would fix them, whether it's the writing, whether it's the production, whether it's the camera cuts, the shaky cam, the announcing, whatever it may be. The length of the show. But then you sort of realize that product, just the way it is, the writing, the comedy, 3 hours of Raw, like all of it, the product as it is, that's what got them $1 billion from Fox. That's what got them another billion or so over 10 years, I think it is, with NBC Universal. They got all that money for the product exactly the way that it is. And it could be a depressing thought when you, if you are somebody who is not a very big fan of what WWE is doing, and you wish they would make wholesale changes and creative and whatnot, it's a very depressing thing to think about that, oh my God, you know, they paid all this money to them for exactly what we see on television every single week. They may not want WWE to make any changes. You know, and why would they? If you're WWE, I talked about this last week, you know, the realization as a longtime fan, a hardcore fan, the realization that it doesn't matter what we want. It no longer matters. You could argue it didn't matter before, but it sure as hell don't matter now, because what incentive is there for them to change? They got all this money for this. There's no reason to change. Beth from Nashville, Tennessee. My coworker and I were recently debating our favorite tag teams from different eras, so I wanted to know, who are your favorite old school, Attitude Era, and modern day tag teams in WWE? Old school era for me is Demolition. Attitude Era had some good teams. I'd probably go Edge and Christian. Honestly, I like the Holly cousins. I just thought they were entertaining. But if I had to pick an Attitude Era team, I'd probably go Edge and Christian. Current era, it's tough, you know. I don't really have any standout favorites, honestly, in the current era. I guess I'd probably go with the Usos. I do think they're one of the best teams in the world right now. But I'm also a fan of Heavy Machinery in NXT, largely because of Otis. Otis is awesome. Mike from Illinois. Safe to say that in hindsight, the Ultimate Warrior really did have the storybook ending that was portrayed in his documentary. He made up with Vince McMahon in the most feel-good way imaginable, complete with the stuff about him considering Vince a father figure. You get the impression that Vince is deeply happy he got to make amends and was hit hard by the man's passing. Do you think WWE's current reverence for the Warrior stems partially from this personal stuff, or is it all just for marketing? It just seems that Vince is overlooking some damning things because of personal affection. Then again, he did the same thing with Moolah. What do you think? I think it's a combination of both. I don't think it's one or the other. I think a lot of it is marketing. I think a lot of it is revisionist history. And look at the whole Warrior Award thing. That is not what the Warrior wanted it to be, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't, especially because now he's dead, right? So it doesn't matter what the dead guy wanted. they can take it and twist it. And, you know, the family, I'm sure, is well taken care of. They're not going to rock the boat. Dana Warrior has a good thing going. She's got a podcast now, and she gets to go to all these red carpet events. And maybe one day her girls are going to want to become wrestlers. And so, you know, everything is set up just the way that the company wants it to be, and they can tell whatever story that they want to tell, whether it's accurate or not. So, yeah, marketing is the large part of it, but I do think Vince has a personal affection for the guy. He kept bringing him back. Look at the way look at the fallouts between the Warrior and Vince over the years and all the horrible comments they made about each other back and forth. And still, Vince always just wanted to bring this guy back. In 96, he wanted to bring him back. In 98, I think there was interest in bringing him back. He went to WCW instead. So there's got to be some personal affection there. Topher from Georgia. Have you watched the new Cobra Kai show on YouTube Red? The trailer comes off like something from College Humor, but the show is actually very good. Yeah, I started, I'm a little late to the Cobra Kai game. I watched the first two episodes that were free on YouTube. I have the other eight episodes all queued up. I'm going to watch the entire series. I believe there's going to be a season two. I know it's done very well. People have been surprised by how good it was. I thought the same thing. When I first saw the trailer, I thought, okay, this is like a really well-done College Humor type thing, but it's not an actual, like, show. And then I found that it was an actual show, and everybody was like, hey, this thing is actually pretty good. And I was never, like, a huge Karate Kid fan when I was younger. I saw the original. I saw the second one. I saw the one with Hilary Swank. Yes, I saw it. Whatever happened to her, by the way? You don't hear about her anymore. So I saw the movies, but I wasn't like this big Karate Kid person, sweep the leg and all this other stuff. I didn't get all the references. But I heard, look, you don't even have to be a big Karate Kid fan. They actually have footage from the original movie that they show at the beginning to kind of clue you in. And you don't have to be somebody who saw the original movie to enjoy the new show. So I watched the first two episodes. I was like, man, this is really good. So I'm looking forward to seeing the other eight. So I'm all in on Cobra Kai. Brian from Orlando, my question is regarding WrestleMania 12 with Diesel versus The Undertaker. If Diesel never gave his notice to go to WCW, do you think he would have won and therefore the streak would never have been born? That is a great question that we will never know the answer to for sure. My guess is that yes, Diesel was going to win. And why would Diesel win? Because he was next in line for a championship match with Shawn Michaels, so why wouldn't he win? Now, they gave him a title shot anyway, but think about it. It didn't make any sense. What sense did it make? He had a match with The Undertaker and lost, and then the very next pay-per-view, he challenges Shawn Michaels for the WWF title. The Undertaker got fucked. So I think if he wasn't leaving, he would have won at WrestleMania. Therefore, it would have made more sense for him to then go on and challenge Shawn for the championship. And I don't think the streak would have ever have been a thing. James from Kentucky, settle a debate for me. Is a hot dog a sandwich? Why is this even a debate anymore? The answer is no. A hot dog is not a sandwich. A hot dog is a hot dog. It is in a category all by itself. And I know Webster's dictionary says otherwise. Fuck Webster. Okay, I don't care. They're wrong. If you look at a menu, go to any diner. Come to New York. Go to any diner in New York. I don't know how it is outside the state, but you come here, you look in a diner menu, okay, under sandwiches, you're going to see grilled chicken sandwiches, you're going to see triple deckers, you're going to see all the wraps, right? All these sandwiches. You will not find a hot dog. You know why? Because it's not a sandwich. It's in the column under hot dogs. Period. End of story. Russell from Galveston, Texas. Buy or sell? This is a good one. I saw this. I said, I got to do this on the show. Buy or sell on who had the better title reign in terms of match quality, not ticket sales or TV ratings or anything else. Bret Hart in 1994 or Shawn Michaels in 1996? That is a good one. Everybody knows I've made, you know, no secret of it in the past. I'm a huge Bret Hart mark, especially from that 92 to 94. Big Bret Hart fan. He's my favorite. If you ask me who's my favorite of all time, if I had to pick one name, it would be Bret Hart. I just, thought he had just fantastic matches and feuds, you know, back in the mid-90s. And even the stuff he did as, you know, the anti-American, you know, Hart Foundation stuff in 97, looking back on it now especially, was pretty groundbreaking stuff at that time. But as far as, you know, WWF title runs, Bret in 94, now the funny thing is him and Shawn both won the championship in their respective years at WrestleMania in March, and they both lost the championship at Survivor Series. So that, they kind of mirrored each other in terms of length. When I look at Bret's reign in 94, he won the title from Yokozuna in a crappy match at WrestleMania 10. He then went on to defend the championship against Diesel, which I think was their first, that was the first of three matches they had between 94 and 95. The King of the Ring match between Bret and Diesel in 94, I mean, had a crappy finish because, you know, Jim Neidhart ran in. It was a DQ finish, but you know, the match I thought was actually pretty good. It was probably the best Diesel had looked at up to that point. He wasn't really, you know, that much of a singles wrestler. So the match wasn't great, but I don't remember the, I think the match was pretty good. But then Bret had that excellent championship match on Raw with the 1-2-3 Kid. He had the championship match on Superstars later that same month at the end of July with Bob Backlund. This was the match where Backlund snapped when the match was over and he turned heel. He put Bret in the chicken wing and it led to what would be the submission match between, or was it submission or I Quit? They had, I think it was a submission match between Bret and Backlund at Survivor Series. Now, I don't remember that match being all that great or all that exciting. It was a fun story they told where Bret was in the chicken wing for like 9 minutes straight. Owen is on the outside crying tears, begging his parents to throw the towel in, and they do. And then Owen, it was all a ruse. Like, Owen was such a great heel during that year. But the first Backlund match, on which was just a TV match, I thought was excellent. I thought that was an excellent, the Superstars match was excellent. And then in the middle, and this is where I kind of have a little bit of difficulty making a decision, because the match at SummerSlam in 94 between Bret and Owen, the cage match, is one of my favorite matches of all time. And in my opinion, it's the best steel cage match. I'm not counting Hell in a Cell matches, but the best steel cage match in WWE history. That match at SummerSlam 94 was just fantastic. And even, and not just the match itself, even, they had all the family members were sitting at ringside. Bulldog, this is the first time British Bulldog, I think, was back in the company since 92. There he is, Jack to the gills, sitting at ringside with his wife. The Anvil is seated behind him. All the drama at the end where Anvil sort of clotheslined him and his wife over the barricade, and all the family members are fighting and Anvil's in the cage. Like, it was chaos. That whole thing, I just love that so much. And so it's hard for me to vote against Bret in 94, but I think I'm going to have to. So I'm going to buy on Shawn having the better reign in 96 over Bret in 94. I'll sell on that. Because when I look at Shawn Michaels in 96, you know, when he won the championship, even though I think that Iron Man match is severely overrated, it was still a very good match. It was a hell of a lot better than Bret beating Yokozuna, you know, WrestleMania 10. So Shawn, right out of the gate, winning the championship, starts with this classic Iron Man, you know, win 62 minutes or whatever it was that it went. The very next month, he has what was Diesel's best match in WWE, maybe the best match of his career, at the In Your House show. They had that No Holds Barred match, which was excellent. Then Shawn had a couple of matches with Bulldog. The second one, the King of the Ring one, I remember being very good in June. He had the match with Vader at SummerSlam in August, which was, it was kind of like three matches in one, right? First, I think Vader won by DQ, then he won by, or he won by countout, then DQ. They kept restarting it, then Shawn finally beat him, but that was a very good match. Then you have the In Your House match in September, Shawn and Mankind. One of the best championship matches you'll ever see. Maybe the, and honestly, one of the best matches of Mick Foley's career. And even Survivor Series, where Shawn lost the championship to Sid at Madison Square Garden. That was a fun match because everybody was booing Shawn out of the building. Sid was just over like gangbusters. And even that match, I thought that match was pretty good. So Shawn just had one great match after another in 96. If you're talking about in-ring match quality and nothing else, Bret had a few excellent matches as champion in 94, but he didn't have as many as Shawn did. So I gotta go Shawn over Bret. And lastly here, this is a non-wrestling question, but somebody asked me on Twitter, and I didn't have a chance to respond to them, and so I figured I would respond here. They wanted my thoughts on the Roseanne situation with her losing her show and people now calling for Samantha Bee to be fired by TBS after she made a very crude remark about Ivanka Trump. And he was asking me this question because he knows I work in public relations. So from a PR point of view, he wanted to know what I basically think about the idea of punishing comedians for saying controversial things. And all I'll say is this. I enjoyed Roseanne's show. I used to watch the original. Actually, not even so much when it first ran. But it's been in reruns for so many years. Like, when I watch it, it's a really good show. And I am a big fan of John Goodman. I'll watch him in almost anything. So when I found out they were rebooting the show with the original cast, including Goodman, and I was in Laurie Metcalf, I was like, wow, this is going to be really cool. I'm going to have to check this out. And by and large, I mean, I thought they did a really good job with the show. I thought the show was actually pretty good. Now, what she said this past week on Twitter, which I won't repeat, was disgustingly racist, and she got what she deserved. But my view on it is this, as far as, you know, what she said, and then the network almost immediately came out and announced that she was basically fired, and they were canceling the show, even though the show did great ratings, and it had already been renewed after one episode for a second season. ABC pulled the plug. At the end of the day, it's the network's call. You can call them hypocrites for getting into bed with her in the first place, and you can call them hypocrites for a million different things. It's their network, it's their show. They felt like they had to cut ties with her completely, and that's their right. They did not want to be associated with somebody like that. Completely understandable. You know, there's just certain lines you do not cross. It doesn't matter whether you're a comedian or not, right? There's just certain really stupid things that should not be said, especially in a public forum. You would think somebody would have more common sense than that. I personally would love for them to keep the show, but just build it around all the other characters. And it sounds like they're actually having conversations, ABC is, about doing just that. There is the possibility that her show may come back under a different name with pretty much the entire cast except her. So, and I would be okay with that. I really would. If it was built around John Goodman and Laurie Metcalf, and it's very easy, too. You just say that Roseanne died from an opioid overdose, and you just move on. So I hope it works out in the end. And look, John Goodman is going to be fine. Laurie Metcalf is going to be fine. I'm sure they have people knocking down their door. They're not hurting for work. But there's literally hundreds of people who worked on that show who got fucked over when she made that one stupid tweet. It's not fair to them. And if they could put the show back together without her, I hope they do it. Now, the whole Samantha Bee thing, Samantha Bee is another numbskull. Me personally, I've never found her funny. I just didn't. I used to love The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. I thought it was funny. And, you know, John Oliver, I like him. He's funny. And even Trevor Noah. Like, I don't watch The Daily Show really anymore, but what clips I've seen of him, I was not a big fan of his at first. I do think he's a funny guy, or he can be. I never found her funny. I just was never, even her segments on The Daily Show, I almost would like tune out. There was just something about her I just did not find funny. Now, if they fire her, again, that's up to TBS. It's their call. They have the right to hire and fire as they see fit. And I already see some sponsors have started pulling out. So they have to make a decision on what they're going to do here. I don't think in the end they're going to actually get rid of her, but that's their call to make. It's up to them. There is a difference, though, between racism and vulgarity. I can be vulgar on this show. I am sometimes, right? I can be vulgar on this show. Not the way Samantha Bee was. I think the comment she made was completely stupid and completely uncalled for. But, like, in my case, I don't have a network that I have to answer to. I have an audience. They either like my content and they listen to it or they don't. It's very simple. But nobody gets to tell me whether or not I can keep doing my show. These people don't have that luxury because they're being paid as representatives of a network. Networks that, in most cases, by the way, are paying them very handsomely. They have to behave a certain way. If I was working in PR for ABC or TBS, you have to take action the way that, like ABC did. The worst thing you could do, though, is say nothing or just hope that it passes. But, you know, this argument that, oh, comedians can't be comedians, you know, anymore. Sure they can. But when these comedians sign, let's say, a $3 million contract or a $5 million contract with a major television network, there's going to be certain lines you cannot cross. And if you don't like that, you're free to do the starving artist routine and take your act on the road and be your own boss. And on that note, I think we'll wrap up the mailbag. You can keep sending in your questions, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter, @solemonster. Next Saturday is a big day. It is CM Punk's second and possibly final UFC fight. It will be final if it goes as well as his first fight did. UFC 225 against Mike Jackson. It's also the big New Japan Dominion show with Okada Omega 4 for the IWGP Championship. Best 2 out of 3 falls with no time limit. I believe the reign of Okada comes to an end in Osaka next weekend, and Omega gets the title. We also have Chris Jericho taking on Tetsuya Naito. Naito is my pick there. And Rey Mysterio Jr. makes his New Japan in-ring debut against an opponent to be determined. Maybe Will Ospreay. We'll see. I plan on watching the show, and if so, I will have a review for that, as well as thoughts on Punk's fight, all as part of episode 550 next Sunday. 550 episodes. Can you believe it? Didn't I just feel like I just got done celebrating 500 shows, and we had that live YouTube show? Where does time go? So, going to be a big podcast next weekend, episode 550. You will not want to miss that. Until then, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a great week. Thank you again for all the kind comments about my knee, which hopefully will continue to heal up and hopefully will not have to be reopened. My knee is not a cold case. It is not a restaurant. It should not be reopened. And anyway, I'll see you guys back here for more Sound Off next weekend. Until then, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solemonster sounds off.
If WWE were a person, how would you describe them? It's just a very bizarre question. But these are the different options they gave as passionate, talented, funny, modest, except for all those did you know facts they pepper us with every single week. Kind, cheerful, sweet, surprising, adventurous, flexible. How the fuck can an organization be flexible? This is a real survey question here. You would think you were going on a date. I have no interest in dating WWE. They're clingy, they're painfully unfunny, and all they do is talk about themselves. They're not my type.
The Monster Sounds Off.
Since 2007, The Solemonster Sounds Off. Available at thesolemonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solo Monsters Sound Off.